Tune in on Thursday, August 31st at 8 p.m. to celebrate the queer programmers and the queer community of KBOO as part of our 50th anniversary. Emma Lugo of Transpositive will host this special on-air program. You can join us that night at the Queer Community Open House here at KBOO at 20 Southeast Avenue from 7 to 10 p.m. on August 31st. More information about the Queer Community Open House and anniversary programming is available at kboo.fm.
This is KBOO Portland. We're available on 90.7 FM at K2BH Philomath on 104.3 FM and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM and on the web at kboo.fm. Coming up this morning on KBOO, next at 9 o'clock on alternative radio, journalist and author Chris Hedges connects the dangers of extraction industries and sexploitation. At 10, it's Eric Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary, and at 10:15, it's Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. At 11, on stage and studio, Dewey May and Susanna Mars welcome actress, comedian, and activist Margaret Cho, who returns to Portland with her Fresh Off the Boat tour. And at 11:30 on Art Focus, they talk to Glenn Clevenger and Ann Hamilton about their paintings and sculptures on view now in Portland. Today we can expect a hot day with unhealthful air quality due to smoke from regional wildfires. Temperatures will reach the high 90s. KBOO programming is made possible by member support. If you'd like to become a member, go to kboo.fm and click on Donate.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the August Amzi After Dark, featuring Insexuality, Ultrasonic Love Songs, and Death Dances from the Panamanian Rainforest on Wednesday, August 29th at 7:30 p.m. at Amzi in Portland. What does the world sound like to an insect or a bat? You can find out by exploring the insect music you've never heard before in surround sound under the Panamanian stars. Again, that's Amzi After Dark, featuring Insexuality, Ultrasonic Love Songs, and Death Dances from the Panamanian Rainforest on Wednesday, August 29th at 7:30 p.m. at the Oregon Museum of Science and Industry, 1945 Southeast Water Avenue in Portland. This is a 21 and over event. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO programming is made possible by KBOO member listeners and support from Oregon Symphony, located at 909 Southwest Washington Street in downtown Portland, presenting Gary Trudeau, political cartoonist and creator of Doonesbury Comics, sharing from his latest book, Sad, Doonesbury in the Time of Trump, on Tuesday, October 16th at 7:30 p.m. Tickets and more information are available by phone at 503-228-1353 or online at orsymphony.org.
Absolute power over another, as I saw repeatedly in the wars I covered, almost always expresses itself through sexual sadism. And this is why rape, porn, and prostitution of women by men is so prevalent in war, just as it is in mining camps, oil fields, the tar sands, and other extraction industries.
That's Chris Hedges, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamian. This edition of AR features Chris Hedges on extraction industries and sexploitation. The scourge of male violence against women will not end if we dismantle capitalism. It is a separate evil. The fight to end patriarchy and misogyny, all part of a global struggle by women, must take primacy in our own work. Women and girls, especially those who are poor and of color, cannot take part in a liberation movement until they are liberated. They cannot offer us their wisdom, leadership, and passion until they are freed from discrimination, physical coercion, and intimidation. This is why the fight to end male violence around the world is not only fundamental to our movement, but will define its success or failure. None of us is free until all of us are free. Our guest today is Chris Hedges. Chris Hedges is an award-winning journalist. He writes a weekly column for Truthdig. But he's much more than a journalist. He's a brilliant critic of the media, the corporatocracy, neoliberalism, and politics. This program is part of our special month-long tribute to Chris Hedges. It was recorded in 2015. And now, Chris Hedges.
So it's an honor to be here. I'm a father of four children, and you know, much of what I do in my life is centered around the attempt by these forces to rob them of a future. And this really has come down to the fight of our lives. And if we don't radically reconfigure our relationship to each other and to the planet, we are going to very soon have to begin to discuss the extinction of the human species itself. I have walked through the barren remains of Babylon in Iraq, and the ancient Roman city of Antioch, the capital of Roman Syria, which now lies buried in silt deposits. I have visited the marble ruins of Leptis Magna, one of the most important agricultural centers in the Roman Empire, now isolated in the desolate drifts of sand southeast of Tripoli. I've climbed at dawn up the Mayan temples in Tikal, while flocks of brightly colored toucans leapt through the jungle foliage below. I've stood amid the remains of the ancient Egyptian city of Luxor along the Nile, looking at the statue of the great pharaoh Ramses II lying in pieces on the ground, with Percy Shelley's poem Ozymandias running through my head. My name is Ozymandias, King of Kings. Look on my works, ye mighty, and despair. Nothing beside remains. Round the decay of that colossal wreck, boundless and bare, the lone and level sands stretch far away. Civilizations rise, decay, and die. Imperialism, like colonialism, consumes itself. Time, as the ancient Greeks argued, for individuals and for states, is cyclical. As civilizations become more complex, they become inevitably more precarious. They become increasingly vulnerable. And as they begin to break down, there is a strange retreat by a terrified and confused population from reality, an inability to acknowledge the self-evident fragility and impending collapse. The elites at the end speak in phrases and jargon that do not correspond to reality. They live isolated in guarded compounds, whether at the court, at Versailles, the Forbidden City, or our modern palatial estates. The elites indulge in unchecked hedonism, the accumulation of greater and greater personal wealth and extravagant consumption. And they are deaf to the mounting suffering of the masses that are repressed with greater and greater ferocity. Life becomes about accumulating as much as fast as you can on the way down. Resources are ruthlessly depleted until they are exhausted, and then the hollowed out edifice collapses. The Roman and Sumerian empires fell this way. The Mayan elites, after clearing their forests and polluting their streams with silt and acids, retreated backwards. As food and water shortages expand across the globe, as we engage in dirtier and more environmentally destructive forms of extracting natural resources, especially fossil fuels, as poverty and misery triggers uprisings and street protests in the Middle East, Africa, and Europe, the elites do what all elites do. They build a pervasive security and surveillance apparatus to protect themselves and those who plunder and destroy on their behalf. They launch endless wars, which for them means endless profits. They construct grander monuments to themselves. They plunge their nations deeper into debt. And as the edifice around them shakes and unravels, they take it out on the backs of workers and the poor. They drive them harder and harder to maintain a level of consumption and a level of profit that is unsustainable. The collapse of the global economy, which wiped out a staggering $40 trillion in wealth, was caused when our elites, after destroying our manufacturing base, sold massive quantities of fraudulent mortgage-backed securities to pension funds, small investors, banks, universities, state and foreign governments, and shareholders. The elites, to cover the losses, then looted the public treasury to begin the speculation over again. They also, in the name of austerity, began dismantling basic social services, set out to break the last vestiges of unions, slashed jobs, froze wages, threw millions of people out of their homes, and stood idly by as we created a permanent underclass of unemployed and unemployed. And this is how all civilizations ossify and die, and ours is no exception. We are far down the road of self-immolation. We have obliterated 90% of the large fish in the oceans and wiped out half of the mature tropical forests, the lungs of the planet. At this rate, by 2030, only 10% of the Earth's tropical forests will remain. Contaminated water kills 25,000 people a day around the globe. And each year, some 20 million children are impaired by malnourishment. Huge parts of the planet beset with overpopulation, droughts, soil erosion, freak storms, massive crop failures, and rising sea levels will be unfit for human existence. And in a mad bid to capitalize on the last remains of fossil fuels, we carry out vast extraction industries in places like the tar sands that drive this suicidal fury at warp speed. Jared Diamond, in his essay, The Last Americans, notes that by the time Hernan Cortez reached the Yucatan, millions of Mayan subjects had vanished. Why, Diamond writes, did the kings and nobles not recognize and solve these problems? A major reason was that their attention was evidently focused on the short-term concerns of enriching themselves, waging wars, erecting monuments, competing with one another, and extracting enough food from the peasants to support all these activities. Pumping that oil, cutting down those trees, and catching those fish may benefit the elite by bringing them money or prestige, and yet be bad for society as a whole, including the children of the elite in the long run, Diamond went on. Mayan kings were consumed by immediate concerns for their prestige, requiring more and bigger temples, and their success in the next war requiring more followers, rather than for the happiness of commoners or the next generation. Those people with the greatest power to make decisions in our society today regularly make money from the activities that may be bad for society as a whole and for their own children. Those decision makers include Enron executives, many land developers, and advocates of tax cuts for the rich. It was no different on Easter Island. The inhabitants, when they first settled the 64 square mile island during the 5th century, found abundant fresh water and woods filled with Chilean wine palm, a tree that can reach the size of an oak. Seafood, including fish, seals, porpoises, and turtles, and nesting seabirds were plentiful. Easter Island society, which split into an elaborate caste system of nobles, priests, and commoners, had within 5 or 6 centuries swelled to some 10,000 people. The natural resources were devoured and began to disappear. Forest clearance for the growing of crops would have led to population increase, but also to soil erosion and decline of soil fertility. Paul Bunn and John Fenley write in Easter Island, Easter Earth. Progressively more land would have to be cleared. Trees and shrubs would also be cut down for canoe building, firewood, house construction, and for the timbers and ropes needed in the movement and erection of statues. palm fruits would be eaten, thus reducing regeneration of the palm. Rats, introduced for food, could have fed on the palm fruits, multiplied rapidly, and completely prevented palm regeneration. The over-exploitation of prolific seabird resources would have eliminated those for all but the offshore islets. Rats could have helped in this process by eating eggs. The abundant food provided by fishing, seabirds, and rats would have encouraged rapid initial human population growth. Unrestrained human population increase would later put pressure on availability of land, leading to disputes and eventually warfare. Non-availability of timber and rope would make it pointless to carve further statues. A disillusionment with the efficacy of the statue religion in providing the wants of the people could lead to the abandonment of this cult. Inadequate canoes would restrict fishing to the inshore waters, leading to the further decline in protein supplies. The result could have been general famine, warfare, and collapse of the whole economy, leading to a marked population decline. Clans in the latter part of the Easter Island civilization competed to honor their ancestors by constructing larger and larger hewn stone images, which demanded the last remnants of the timber, rope, and manpower on the island. By the year 1400, the woods were gone. The soil had eroded and washed into the sea. The islanders began to fight over old timbers and were reduced to eating their dogs and what remained of the nesting birds. The desperate islanders developed a belief system that posited that the erected stone gods, the Moe, would come to life and save them from disaster. This last retreat into magic, anthropologists call these crisis cults, characterizes all societies that fall into terminal decline. It is a frantic response to the loss of control, as well as despair and powerlessness. This desperate retreat into magic led to the Cherokee Ghost Dance, the doomed Take Onkwai revolt against the Spanish invaders in Peru, and the Aztec prophecies of the 1530s. Civilizations in the last moments become self-deluded as reality becomes too bleak to be absorbed. The modern belief by evangelical Christians in the rapture, which does not exist in biblical literature, is no less fantastic. One that at once allows for the denial of global warming and of evolution and the absurd idea that the righteous will all be saved, floating naked upwards into the arms of Jesus at the end of time. The blind faith that science and technology, which are morally neutral and serve human ambition, will make the world whole again, however, is no less delusional. We offer up our magical thinking in secular as well as religious form. Are the events of 300 years ago on a small remote island of any significance to the world at large? Bain and Flenley ask. We believe they are. We consider that Easter Island was a microcosm which provides a model for the whole planet. Like the Earth, Easter Island was an isolated system. The people there believed that they were the only survivors on Earth, all other land having sunk beneath the sea. They carried out for us the experiment of permitting unrestricted population growth, profligate use of resources, destruction of the environment, and boundless confidence in their religion to take care of the future. The result was an ecological disaster leading to a population crash. Do we have to repeat the experiment on this grand scale? Do we have to be as cynical as Henry Ford and say history is bunk? Would it not be more sensible to learn the lesson of Easter Island history and apply it to the Earth Island on which we live? The signs of imminent devastation are undeniable. Common sense demands a radical new response, but the race toward massive species extinction, including our own, accelerates. Canada's environmental and regulations and civil liberties, like those in the United States, have been demolished. Fantasy and illusion, spectacle and entertainment fill our empty emotional and intellectual lives. Fear, manufactured by the state, keeps us compliant as the last vestiges of our civil liberties are stripped away. Paralysis grips us as we stumble towards oblivion. As Sigmund Freud grasped and beyond the pleasure principle and civilization and its discontents, human societies are as intoxicated and blinded by their own headlong rush toward death and destruction as they are by the search for erotic fulfillment. The global economy is built on the erroneous belief that the marketplace, human greed, should dictate human behavior and how we organize societies. It posits that economies can eternally expand. It assures us that the ecosystem can continue to be battered by massive carbon emissions without major consequences. It promises that there will always be plentiful and cheap oil. And its systems of propaganda and education, where universities churn out technically proficient systems managers trained only in how to maintain and perpetuate global capitalism, reflect back to us these absurdities. The inability to confront simple truths about human nature and the natural world, the failure to question predatory economics, leaves us unable to articulate new social, economic, and political paradigms. But when civilizations die, it is not only a physical collapse. It is an intellectual and a moral collapse. The sacred is defiled, the common good is abandoned, wisdom is ignored and ridiculed. Reverence is lost. Cult of the self becomes paramount. Hedonism, or what in our society is called personal happiness, becomes the single obsessive goal of existence. And it is achieved at the expense of someone else. It is our right, and as we pursue happiness, in essence adopting the demented mantra fed to us by global capitalism, we too become predators. And this is by design. The Mayan elite became at the end, as the anthropologist Ronald Wright notes in A Short History of Progress, extremists or ultra-conservatives squeezing the last drops of profit from nature and humanity. Oligarchs as Aristotle, Machiavelli, Alex de Tocqueville, Adam Smith, and Karl Marx knew, are schooled in the mechanisms of manipulation, subtle and overt repression and exploitation to protect their wealth and power. Foremost among their mechanism is the control of ideas. Ruling elites ensure that the established intellectual class is subservient to an ideology, in this case, neoliberalism and globalism, that justifies their exploitation of human beings and their unchecked greed. For our misery is their paradise. The ruling ideas are nothing more than the ideal expression of the dominant material relationships, Marx wrote, the dominant material relationships grasped as ideas. The blanket dissemination of the ideology of neoliberalism through the media, academia, systems of entertainment, and even religious creeds, such as those peddled by the Christian right, along with the purging, especially in academia and the press, of critical voices, have permitted our oligarchs to orchestrate the industrial world's largest income inequality gap and normalize the exploitation of the global poor, especially poor people of color. It is not simply that 1% control a quarter of the nation's income in the United States. It is not simply, as Joseph Stiglitz points out, that they have the best houses, the best educations, the best doctors, and the best lifestyles. But they have effectively built systems of indoctrination that determine how we view the world. And until we shatter those systems of indoctrination, until we recover another language and another reality, we remain captive to these oligarchic elites. We remain submissive, not only through the networks of global security, but through the power of ideas. And these ideas have infected the left as effectively as they have infected the mainstream society. The reconfiguration of spirituality to ask, "How is it with me?" replicates the narcissism of the wider culture. The misuse of identity politics as a form of anti-politics, as if electing a woman president who wages endless war and sends out fleets of militarized drones, who is in the pocket of Wall Street and the fossil fuel industry, and who has no intention of reversing the eradication of our civil liberties, is somehow an improvement over a black president who did the same thing. This is not to deny the pervasive racism and sexism that subjugates people of color and women, but to recognize that identity politics has been cynically manipulated by the power elites to refuse to actually redistribute power to the oppressed, and in particular, poor people of color, and perhaps especially women. The shining example of the sickness of a predatory society revolves around the issue that caused some controversy around my talk: the global trade in prostituted girls and women, and the explosion of pornography that attempts to eroticize the domination, torture, and physical abuse of girls and women. Civilizations in decline, from Caligula's Rome to the decadence at the end of the Ottoman and the Austro-Hungarian empires, always become hypersexualized and depraved. The primacy of personal pleasure, obtained at the expense of others, especially the weak, is the defining characteristic of a civilization in its death throes. I spent 2 decades as a reporter covering conflicts, many of them centering around the domination of natural resources in Latin America, the Middle East, Africa, and the Balkans. The only group wars produce in greater numbers than prostituted girls and women are killers, refugees, and corpses. I was with Marine Corps units that were soon to be shipped to the Philippines, where sexual violence directed at Asian women by white men. And any Asian woman in this room can tell you how unrelenting and commonplace such violence and sexual racism is a direct result of Western imperialism, just as sexual violence against Aboriginal women is a direct result of white colonialism. And the same behavior is found on the outskirts of the massive extraction industries that often spawn the wars I covered in places like the Congo. This sexualized racism, however, is hardly limited to wars or extraction sites. It is the driving force behind the millions of first world male sexual tourists that go to the developing world, as well as those who seek out poor women of color who are trafficked to Canada and within Canada. Some of these women, and some of those who engage in this violence and sexualized racism against women, are within a few blocks of where I am speaking tonight. Edward Said defined sexual exploitation as a fundamental feature of Orientalism, which he said was a Western style for dominating, restructuring, and having authority over the Orient. Orientalism, Said wrote, views itself and its subject matter with sexist blinders. The local women are usually the creatures of a male power fantasy. They express unlimited sensuality. They are more or less stupid, and above all, they are willing. Moreover, he went on, when women's sexuality is surrendered, the nation is more or less conquered. The sexual conquest of indigenous women, Said points out, correlates with the conquest of the land itself. Extraction industries like wars empower a predominantly male, predatory population that is engaged in horrific destruction and violence. Wars and extraction industries are designed to extinguish all systems that give life: familial, social, cultural, economic, political, and environmental. And they require the obliteration of community and the common good. How else could you get, as is now happening, drag line operators in southern West Virginia to rip the tops off the Appalachian Mountains to get at coal seams, as they turn the land they grew up in, and often their ancestors grew up in, into a fetid, toxic wasteland where the air, soil, and water will be poisoned for generations. These vast predatory enterprises hold up the possibility of personal wealth, personal advancement, and personal power at the expense of everyone and everything around you. They create a huge, permanent divide between the exploiters and the exploited, one that is rarely crossed. And the more vulnerable you are, the more the jackals appear around you to prey on your afflictions. Those who suffer most are children, women, and the elderly. The children and the elderly because they are vulnerable, the women because they are usually left to care for them. And one of the most poignant scenes in West Virginia, when Joe Sacco and I did our book, Days of Destruction, Days of Revolt, was in the nurse's office of elementary schools where the children kept their rows of little inhalers so they could breathe.
You're listening to Chris Hedges, Extraction Industries and Sexploitation. This is Alternative Radio. You can order copies of this program by calling 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. Or you can order online on our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org.
The sexual abuse of poor girls and women expands the divide between the predators and the prey, the exploiters and the exploited. And in every war zone, like every boomtown that rises up around extraction industries, you find widespread sexual exploitation by bands of men. And this is happening at this moment in the boomtowns rising up around the fracking industry in North Dakota. Downtown San Salvador, when I was there during the war, was filled with streetwalkers, massage parlors, brothels, and nightclubs, where girls and women, driven into the urban slums and refugee camps because of the fighting in their rural communities, bereft of their homes and safety, cut off from their families, were being pimped out to the gangsters and the warlords. And I saw the same exploitation when I reported from Syria, Sarajevo, Belgrade, Nairobi, the Congo, where the Congolese armed forces routinely raped and tortured girls and women, near Anvil's Dekalushi copper mine, as well as Djibouti, where girls and women refugees from the fighting in Ethiopia were herded by traffickers into a poor neighborhood that was an outdoor market for human flesh. I know war's peculiar culture. And sexual slavery, and not incidentally pornography, is always one of war's most lucrative industries. And this is not accidental. For war, like the destruction of the planet for plunder, is also a predatory endeavor. It is a denial of the sacred. It is a turning away from reverence. Human beings, like the earth itself, become objects to destroy or gratify or both. They become commodities that have no intrinsic value beyond a monetary value. The pillage of the earth, like war, is about lust, power, and domination, and this is almost always male domination. The violence, plunder, destruction, forced labor, torture, slavery, and yes, prostitution, are all part of unfettered capitalism, a single evil. And we will stand united or divided against this evil. To ignore some of the oppressed, to ignore parts of this evil, to say that some forms of predatory behavior are acceptable and others are not, is to ignore all of the oppressed. And it will render us powerless before this evil. Their goal is to keep the oppressed divided, and they are doing a very good job. To counter these divisions, it is incumbent on all of us to empower the voices of women across the planet and support and build alliances with women's groups, including those here in Vancouver, such as Vancouver Rape Relief and Women's Shelter, Asian Women Coalition Ending Prostitution, Native Women's Association of Canada, and Feminist Alliance for International Action, that are on the front lines of this struggle. And yet, On this issue, we must start neither from capitalism or environmental degradation, but from the plaintive cry of the oppressed, those women and girls who are subjugated by male violence. While capitalism exploits racism and gender inequality for its own ends, while imperialism and colonialism are designed to reduce women in indigenous culture to sexual slaves, racism and gender equality exist independent from capitalism. And if not consciously named and fought, it will exist even if capitalism is destroyed. This struggle for liberation of women, which goes beyond the goal of dismantling corporate capitalism, asks important and perhaps different questions about the role of government and the use of law. Women who engage in the struggle for liberty across the globe need laws and effective policing to stop from being blackmailed, bullied, denied access to cash and to resources that sustain life, especially as they are disproportionately left with the care of the sick, the young, the old, and the destitute. It is male violence against women that is the primary force used to crush the global collective revolt of women. And male violence against feminists who seek a more peaceful, egalitarian, and sustaining world is pervasive even in Vancouver. To challenge prostitution, to challenge objectification, to challenge hypersexualization of women is to often be threatened with rape, to challenge mining, to stand up to protect water, to assist a truth teller if you are a woman, is to be threatened with not only economic destitution, but violence leading to prostitution. We must, as activists, end that objectification of women and male violence. If we do not, we will never have access to the ideas and leadership of women, and in particular women of color, which is essential to creating an inclusive vision for a better future. So while we must decry violence and exploitation against all of the oppressed, we must also recognize that male violence against women, including prostitution and its porn promoter, is a specific and separate global evil. It is, yes, a tool of capitalism. It is often a product of imperialism and colonialism, but it finally exists outside of capitalism, imperialism, and colonialism. And it is a force that most men in general, and sadly most men on the left, refuse to acknowledge, much less fight. We cannot be free until we are all free. And this is why the struggle for women's liberty, and this is why the struggle for women's liberty is absolutely crucial to our movement. Without that freedom, we cripple ourselves. If you want to understand what it is like to be prostituted, you can read the passage in my book, War is a Force That Gives Us Meaning, where I interview Muslim girls and women who are forced into Serbian brothels and rape camps, usually after their fathers, husbands, and brothers were executed. Or you can read a column I wrote called Recall to Life, where I conducted a lengthy interview with one of the women being prostituted on the streets of Camden, New Jersey, the poorest city in the United States, where I spent many weeks with the cartoonist Joe Sacco for our book, Days of Destruction, Days of Revolt. Camden was like nothing I had ever seen before, Christine Pagano says in the article, adding, the poverty is so bad, people rob you for $5, literally for $5. They would pull a gun on you for no money. I would get out of cars, I would walk 5 feet up the road and get held up, and they would take all my money. The first time it happened to me, I cried an hour. You degrade yourself, you get out of the car, and some guy pulls a gun on you. I gave up on everything at that point. I wanted to die, she says. I didn't care anymore. All the guilt and the shame, and leaving my son, not talking to my son, not talking to my family. The years I spent as a war correspondent did not leave me untouched. I lost many of those I worked with, including Kurt Schork, with whom I covered the wars in Iraq, Bosnia, and Kosovo, to violence. I was captured and taken prisoner in Basra, during the Shiite uprising following the Gulf War and ended up in the hands of the Iraqi secret police. I know a little of what it means to be helpless and physically abused. And after Saddam Hussein drove the Kurds out of northern Iraq, my translator, a young woman, disappeared in the chaotic flight. It took me weeks to find her. And when I did, she was being pimped out, numb with trauma. The moment when I found her and the sobs she shed would cure anyone of the notion that selling your body for sex is like trading a commodity on the stock market. Some of the organizers of this conference sent a note before I arrived commenting on my condemnation of prostitution in my column, The Whoredom of the Left, saying that prostitution was, quote, complex and multifaceted. The note went on to assure participants in the conference that the Institute of Humanities did not, quote, take sides in this difficult and extremely contentious debate. But there's nothing complex or multifaceted about prostitution, not when you strip it down to a brief and brutal act of physical violence. It turns you into a piece of meat, and it does not matter if this is in an alley or a hotel room. And the diseases, trauma, physical maiming, and injury, along with a shortened life expectancy, are all well documented in study after study of girls and women who are prostituted. Prostitution fits perfectly into the paradigm of global capitalism. The physical scars, diseases, and shortened life expectancy of the miners I lived with in Siglo Bente, tin mine in Bolivia, most dying in middle age from silicosis, is yet another manifestation of the predatory nature of capitalism. No one chooses to die of silicosis or black lung disease. No one chooses to sell his or her body on the street. You go into the mines like you go into prostitution because global capitalism does not offer you another choice. In Canada, young women and girls of Native descent are forced into street prostitution in numbers far disproportionate to white women. Summer Rain Bentham of the Squamish Nation, who lived and worked in the downtown East Side, told me. Our lives are deemed less valuable because the Western world has decided that we are worthless. These racist views create a hierarchy based on race, even within prostitution itself, for women. This means some women are indoors in strip clubs or agencies. Sometimes she might be educated, and in some cases she might actually believe she has another option other than prostitution. This racist hierarchy leaves Aboriginal women on the bottom, in this case in the survival prostitution with no choices, experiencing a level of violence that is hard to fathom or comprehend. Violence that will never leave her, and that is perpetuated by men not only because we are women, but because we are Native women. It is men's privilege, power, and entitlement in the world that keeps women entrenched in prostitution. It is men who benefit from Native women continuing to be at the bottom. Prostitution is not what most women who have ever been prostituted or women who have never faced being prostituted would choose to do. Prostitution is not what we want for any woman or girl. We are called to build a world where all people have the opportunity to choose security, safety, and well-being over jobs that leave them traumatized, sick, maimed, and destroyed. I don't see the point of this fight if that is not our goal. Sexual violence and sexual submission cannot be set apart. Although the traffickers, pimps, brothel, massage parlor owners, Johns, and their apologists would like us to do so. From unfettered capitalism and the legacy of colonialism and imperialism, it is an integral piece of a world where wholesale industrial slaughter kills hundreds of innocents in Gaza and over a million innocents in Iraq and Afghanistan, where the mentally ill are thrown onto streets, where a country like the United States warehouses 2.3 million people, mostly poor people of color, 25% of the world's prison population in cages for decades, where life for the working poor is one long emergency, It is all one world. It is all one system. And this system in its entirety must be overthrown and destroyed if we have any hope of enduring as a species. It is not accidental that the Abu Ghraib images that were released and the hundreds that remain classified resemble stills from porn films. There is a shot of a naked man in the few photos that were leaked, kneeling in front of another man as if performing oral sex. There is a photo of a naked man on a leash held by a female American soldier. There are photos of naked men in chains. There are photos of naked men stacked one on top of the other in a human pile on the floor, as if in a prison gangbang. And there are hundreds more classified photos that purportedly show forced masturbation by Iraqi prisoners and the rape of prisoners, including young boys, by U.S. soldiers, many schooled in these techniques in our vast system of mass incarceration. The sexualized images reflect the racism, callousness, and perversion that runs like a raging undercurrent through our predatory culture. It is the language of absolute control, total domination, racial hatred, and fetishistic images of slavery and humiliating submission. It is a world without pity. It is about reducing human beings to commodities, to objects. And it is part of a cultural malaise that will kill us as assuredly as the continued exploitation of the tar sands. The object of our corporate culture, neoliberal ideology, imperialism, and colonialism is to strip people of their human attributes. Our identity as distinct human beings must be removed. Our history and our dignity must be obliterated. And the First Nations communities have waged a valiant struggle against this process for generations. The goal is to turn every form of life into a commodity to exploit. And girls and women are high on the list. In my book, Empire of Illusion, I devote a chapter, the longest chapter in the book, to pornography, which is, in essence, filmed prostitution. In porn, a woman is not a person but a toy, a pleasure doll. She exists to gratify what any male determines gives him pleasure. She has no other purpose. Her real name vanishes. She adopts a cheap and vulgar stage name. She becomes a slave. She is filmed being degraded and physically abused. She is filmed being tortured, and the majority of those tortured in pornography are Asian women. This film is sold to customers. The customers are aroused by the illusion that they too can dominate and abuse women. Absolute power over another, as I saw repeatedly in the wars I covered, almost always expresses itself through sexual sadism. And this is why rape, porn, and prostitution of women by men is so prevalent in war, just as it is in mining camps, oil fields, the tar sands, and other extraction industries. Our capitalism, along with imperialism and colonialism, its natural extension, is perpetuated by racist stereotypes. Some of you may have seen the film American Sniper, and you should watch the parody Canadian Sniper on YouTube if you haven't seen it, where Iraqis are turned into one-dimensional, evil human bomb portals that deserve to be gunned down by the hero in the film, even if they are women and children. Those who set out to destroy another people in their land, whether in Iraq or the territories of the First Nations, must dehumanize who live on, nurture, and love that land. This dehumanization is used to justify domination. Imperialism, like colonialism, depends on racial stereotypes, including sexualized racism and the forced prostitution of women of color, to annihilate the culture, dignity, and finally resistance of indigenous populations. And this has been as true in Canada as it has been in Africa, Asia, Latin America, and the Middle East. Indigenous traditions and values are portrayed as primitive and worthless. The oppressed are turned into subhumans, people whose lives do not really matter, who stand in the way of the glories of Western civilization and progress, people who deserve to be eradicated. And you can see this racism on display in porn. Black men are primitive animals, brawny and illiterate studs with vast sexual prowess. Black women are filled with raw, animalistic lust. Latin women are hot and racy. Asian women are meek, sexually submissive geishas. Porn, as Gail Dines writes, is the new minstrel show. It speaks in the racist cant that is the staple of the dominant white culture, and particularly male culture. What is done to girls and women through prostitution is a version of what is done to all of those who do not sign on to the demented project of global capitalism. And if we have any chance of fighting back, we will have to stand for all the oppressed, all those who have become prey. To fail to do this will be to commit moral and finally political suicide. To turn our backs on some of the oppressed is to fracture our power. It is to obliterate our moral authority. It is to fail to see that the entire system of predatory exploitation seeks to swallow and devour us all. To be a radical is to stand with all who are turned into objects, and especially girls and women, who the global economy and much of the left has abandoned. Andrea Dworkin got it. Capitalism, she wrote, is not wicked or cruel when the commodity is the whore. Profit is not wicked or cruel when the alienated worker is a female piece of meat. Poverty is not wicked or cruel when it is the poverty of dispossessed women who have only themselves to sell. Violence by the powerful against the powerless is not wicked or cruel when it is called sex. Slavery is not wicked or cruel when it is sexual slavery. Torture is not wicked or cruel when the tormented are women. The new pornography is left wing, and the new pornography is a vast graveyard where the left has gone to die. The left cannot have its whores and its politics too. The Europeans and Euro-Americans who conquered, exploited, and murdered indigenous communities were not only making war on a people and the earth, but on a competing ethic. The traditions of the First Nations and the pre-modern indigenous societies, the communal structures of these societies, had to be destroyed for colonists and global capitalists to be implant the negative ethic of capitalism. In indigenous societies, hoarding at the expense of others was despised. In these societies, all ate or none ate. Those who were respected were those who shared what they had with the less fortunate and who spoke in the language of the sacred. These older indigenous cultures held fast to the concept of reverence. It is the capacity to honor the sacred, including the sacredness of all life, and here I speak as a vegan and include animals, which capitalism, colonialism, and imperialism seeks to eradicate. We need to listen to women, and especially indigenous women, as we seek to recover this older ethic. They treat Mother Earth like they treat women. Lisa Bruner, the program specialist for the National Indigenous Women's Resource Center, said, "They think they can own us, buy us, sell us, trade us, rent us, poison us, rape us, destroy us, use us as entertainment, and kill us." I'm happy to see that we are talking about the level of violence that is occurring against Mother Earth, because it equates to us, women. What happens to her happens to us. We are the creators of life. We carry that water that creates life, just as Mother Earth carries the water that maintains our life. So I'm happy to see our men standing here, but remind you that when you stand for one, you must stand for the other. The earth is littered with the physical remains of past empires and civilizations, ruins that cry out to us about human folly and hubris. We seem condemned as a species to drive ourselves into extinction, although this moment appears to be the denouement to the whole sad show of settled, civilized life that began some 5,000 years ago. There is nothing left on the planet to seize. We are spending down the last remnants of our natural capital, including our forests, fossil fuel, air, and water. This time, collapse will be global. There are no new lands left to pillage, no new peoples to exploit. Technology, which has obliterated the constraints of time and space, has turned our global village into a global death trap. The fate of Easter Island will be writ large across the vast expanse of planet Earth. The ethic peddled by capitalists and imperialist elites, the cult of the self, the banishing of empathy, the belief that violence can be used to make the world conform, requires the destruction of the communal and the destruction of the sacred. This ethic, if not broken, will mean the end of not only human society, but finally the human species. The elites who orchestrate this pillage, like the elites who pillaged other parts of the globe in the past, probably believe they can outrun their own destructiveness. They think that their wealth, privilege, and gated communities will save them. Or maybe they do not think about the future at all. But the death march they have begun, the relentless contamination of air, soil, and water, the physical collapse of communities, and the eventual exhaustion of coal and fossil fuel themselves, will not spare them or their families, although they may be able to hold out a little longer in their privileged enclaves than the rest of us. They too will succumb to the poisoning of the natural elements, the climate dislocations, the freak weather caused by global warming, the spread of new deadly viruses, the food riots and huge migrations that have already begun, as the desperate flee from flooded or drought-stricken pockets of the earth. The predatory structures of capitalism, imperialism, and colonialism will have to be destroyed. The earth and those forms of life that inhabit the earth will have to once again be revered and protected. This means including a very different vision of human society. It means rebuilding a world where domination and ceaseless exploitation is a sin, and empathy, especially for the weak and the vulnerable, including the planet itself, that has long given us life, is held up as the highest virtue. It means recovering the capacity for awe, for reverence, for the sources of life. Once we stand up for this ethic, once we include all people, including girls and women, as an integral part of this ethic, we can build a resistance movement that can challenge the corporate forces that, if left in power, will extinguish us all. Thank you.
That was Chris Hedges on extraction industries and sexploitation. He spoke at Simon Fraser University in Burnaby, British Columbia. Chris Hedges is an award-winning journalist. He writes a weekly column for Truth Dig and is the author of many books, including Wages of Rebellion. Our special tribute to Chris Hedges includes this program and Captain Ahab and U.S. Empire, Moral Imperatives, and Stopping Fascism. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. To place a credit card order for a CD, MP3, or written transcript of today's program, Chris Hedges, Extraction Industries and Sexploitation, call us at 1-800-444-1977. Again, that number is 1-800-444-1977. Or you can order on our website, alternativeradio.org. The Kronos Quartet performs our theme music. Joe Ritchie is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamian. Thank you for listening.
Coming up this morning on KBOO, next, it's Flashpoints. Next, it's Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, it's Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. At 11, on stage in studio, D-May and Susanna Mars welcome actress, comedian, and activist Margaret Cho, who returns to Portland with her Fresh Off the Boat tour. And at 11:30, on Art Focus, they talk to Glenn Clevenger and Anne Hamilton about their paintings and sculpture on view now in Portland. KBOO programming is made possible by member support. If you'd like to become a member, go to kboo.fm and click on Donate.
Hi, I'm Rick Mitchell, and I would like to invite you to check out my program, Jazz in the New Millennium, at kboo.fm. Each one-hour program focuses on a living jazz artist, putting their work in historical perspective, from their earliest recordings to their most recent. The current season features such legends as McCoy Tyner, Wynton Marcellus, and Dee Dee Bridgewater, as well as rising stars Julian Lage, Joy Alexander, and Tia Fuller. New shows are posted weekly, and you can also find the complete first season. The program is syndicated nationally by the African American Public Radio Consortium, but it can be heard anytime on KBOO's website by going to the drop-down menu on the homepage, clicking on Audio, then Podcasts, and scrolling down to the Jazz in the New Millennium page. That's Jazz in the New Millennium with Rick Mitchell at KBOO.FM.
You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM, and on the web at kboo.fm. KBOO programming is made possible by KBOO listener members and support from Oregon Zoo Summer Concerts, presenting Punch Brothers and Andrew Bird Saturday, October 18th at the Oregon Zoo Amphitheater starting at 7 p.m. Doors open at 5 p.m. and all ages are welcome. Tickets and more information are available online at zooconcerts.com.